Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. In this week's episode, we'll be previewing upcoming elections in the Netherlands. And along the way, we'll be asking the all-important question, why did the Dutch government collapse yet again? And who is going to win in the snap election in November? It is Saturday, the 16th of September, 2023.
To be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
And joining me from the other side of the world, as always, is my co-host Sam. So, Sam, we're going full speed again with podcasts coming out every week, and to paraphrase another certain British politician who made headlines when I was there, we haven't been sitting on our ass and done nothing, have we?
I didn't expect Gillian Keegan to make a feature in this week's podcast, but no, we haven't. I mean, it's going to be a busy few months ahead, as it always is. Autumn and April, May season tend to be the busiest time for national elections, and this autumn is no exception to that rule. And to be honest, it's usually quite a busy period for scheduled elections, and yet we're going to be talking about two national elections this week that weren't scheduled at all to happen this year, were they?
No, we are not. And actually, speaking of busyness in terms of this podcast, I thought I'd quickly update you on the situation of what's happening in Guatemala. Literally 2 days after we put the episode up to air, the Guatemalan president-elect, Bernardo Alvarillo, has announced that he's suspending the presidential transition process after officials from the Ministry of Public Works were pursuing multiple investigations relating to the registration of Alvarillo's Seed Movement Party, alleging fraud in the election. And he has called, and he says he's ready to call people onto the streets. So, Sam, really, it is a moving story. It shows you how quickly politics can move in a short period of time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we talked last week about how we thought it was going to be potentially a turbulent period between the election and inauguration, but I don't think we quite expected it to all unravel so quickly after our recording.
No, we are certainly not. And we want to talk about things unraveling. We have two countries here we would like to talk about. We'll soon be turning our attention to the Netherlands, but let's turn our attention to Eastern Europe for a while. And the theme of this week is really snap elections, because we'll be talking about the Eastern European country of Slovakia, who is going to the polls on the 30th of September for a snap election taking place 1 year earlier than expected. So, Sam, let's set the scene. How do we get to this point, and what has the situation been over the last 4 years?
Yeah, so Slovakia is going to the polls, as you said, at the end of this month to elect all 150 seats on its national council. And the early election this time came around eventually after the collapse of the government back in December, actually. So it's been quite a long time since we had a, I guess, democratically elected government in Slovakia, because between December and now, it has actually been a technocratic government led by Ludovít Odor, who is the fourth prime minister in Slovakia in 3.5 years. So they've had quite the turnover in the last 4 years. And really, that's the reason why we're in the position we're in, because 3 years ago, the 2020 election was won by the Ordinary People and Independent Personalities Party, which was an anti-corruption party led by Igor Matovic, who has been quite a contentious figure in Slovakian politics and is one of the reason the coalitions have been so fragmented in the last 3 years. And this cycle seems to be a straight shootout between the SMER party, led by Robert Fico, who has previously been the Prime Minister of Slovakia, in a shootout with the Progressive Slovakia Party, led by Michal Šimečka, which is the party of the current Slovakian president, Zuzana Kapitova. So that's the situation we have. And you'll notice in that I didn't at all mention Igor Matovich or the Ordinary People and Independent Personalities Party, because really they fallen completely off the radar. And as I expect we're going to unpack Chern in the next 10 to 20 minutes or so, it's not really that straightforward what's going to happen in this election between those two parties, is it?
It is anything but straightforward, I would say. And, you know, you talk about Prime Minister Igor Matovich, you cannot really talk about what has happened in the last 3 years of Slovakian politics, even though he was only Prime Minister, Sam, for a short period of time. He was only Prime Minister from when the Ordinary People's and Independence Personality, or Oleno, won the election, to April 2021, isn't it?
Yeah, so his party won the 2020 election. They got 53 seats, and the outgoing Prime Minister, Peter Pellegrini's Social Democracy Party, which is SMER, now led by Robert Fico again, who they only had 38 seats. So it's quite a big result for Alano, Igor Matovic's party, but they needed to form a coalition. They formed a four-party coalition with We Are Family, Freedom and Solidarity, and For the People, who had 95 of 150 seats. So quite a stable coalition, you would think. However, one of the big problems in March 2020 was that they did agree to form a coalition, but at the time they didn't agree any kind of governing platform at all. So really they got off to doomed start, some might say, from the very beginning, not agreeing what their programme of government was even going to be. And those four parties do come from slightly different ideological backgrounds as well. So it's really just agreeing a coalition in principle without any policy platform at all. And yes, by April 2021, after Igor Matovich agreed to purchase Sputnik V vaccines from Russia, several of the parties expressed discontent in the coalition and it completely collapsed. The agreement was then they were going to reform the coalition with the same parties on the understanding that Igor Matovich was not going to lead it. So he swapped places with his finance minister, Eduard Heger, who then became the prime minister from March 2021. Fast forward to summer 2022, so another year and few months, and the Freedom and Solidarity Party decided to leave the government and left the government in a minority. And really, between that summer and the December, the coalition began to completely unravel. The Freedom and Solidarity Party proposed a no confidence vote in the government over rising energy costs and inflation. And even in that period, Igor Matovic offered his resignation as finance minister because it was understood that he was sort of pulling the strings behind the scenes during Eduard Heger's tenure as prime minister. But even that offer to resign didn't fend it off. The no confidence vote passed. And eventually, 9 months down the line, we've had a technocratic government and we're getting ready for the snap election.
I'd just like to add several comments there and provide some more interesting stories of what has happened along those 3 years. I do think that, yes, there was, I mean, you were right, there was probably doom from the start, where it was more the fact that they didn't even produce that joint program for government, which you usually would see coalition governments produce. But I think on the whole, you would describe this government as largely centre-to-centre-right government and a pro-EU government. And that is crucial to explaining why the Sputnik V vaccine, 200,000 doses of which was welcomed by Prime Minister Igor Matovic and the Health Minister Marek Krajicek in March 2021, is so damaging, because you were seen as turning east. And the context of it as was the fact that Igor Matovic succeeded Robert Fico, who is going to be a figure we're going to be returning to, I suspect, in our discussion of Slovak politics, as a figure who has dominated Slovak politics for over 20 years, but has been accused of turning Slovakia from pro-EU towards pro-Russia, which I think was part of the reason why Igor Matovic in March 2021 had to go.
Yeah, and I guess you wanted to, you could extend this Slovakian political crisis back a few years before the 2020 election, because the end of Robert Fico's premiership and the Peter Pellegrini takeover of the Social Democracy Party was also marred with scandal, because there was a huge wave of anti-government protests in 2018 demanding the resignation of Robert Fico, because an investigative journalist, Jan Kuciak, was found murdered after investigating tax fraud of businessmen with high-level Slovakian political connections. So really, the political crisis has been going on for the last 5 or 6 years rather than the last 3 years. And it seems almost strange that you've had the anti-government, anti-corruption period in Slovakia, a huge wave led Olano into government, and now 3 years later, Olano's not really in the conversation at all. And who is in the conversation? Robert Fico, leading the Social Democracy Party.
So there you go. You cannot write some people off, can you? I should say as well that I would say Igor Matovic's other problem was that he admitted to plagiarizing his master's thesis after an investigation found that he lifted entire pages and even charts from sources. Now that is next level industrial plagiarism, isn't it, Sam?
Yes, yeah, that's unfortunate.
And I would like to talk about the relationship between Olano and SAS in June 2022, which led to the decision to quit, SAS to quit. And what that did was, I think, started the long death knell of this government. It plunged the government from majority government to minority government, and a no-confidence vote against Matovic, who crucially remained deputy prime minister. And I still think he's even more key, the leader of Olano. So I think he tried to do similar to what, ironically, Robert Fico did in 2018. Would you not agree, Sam? Which is to promote somebody else to be prime minister, but by remaining party leader, really try and control the strings behind the scenes, isn't it?
Yeah, the more I was researching about Slovakia, the more there were some interesting parallels to be drawn between Robert Fico and Igor Matovic. They're quite similar political figures, even if they come from very different political traditions.
And to talk about some of Igor Matovic really took a disliking towards SAS and its leader, Richard Sule, which led to the SAS withdrawing from government and his resignation as deputy prime minister and economy minister. So I'll give you three examples. Igor Matovic called Richard Sule and, quote, idiot over his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is never good for coalition relations. He also repeatedly claimed that SAS was responsible for the fall of Ivica Radičeva's government in 2011, which led to the return of Robert Fico in 2012. So he clearly, Igor Matovic is somebody who has held grudges. And thirdly, it is over a key piece of tax reform, which, I kid you not, Igor Matovic's finance minister called the Tax Revolution Makes Dreams Come True package of pro-family measures. And he excluded SAS from such negotiations, which led, obviously, SAS to strongly criticize the package. And he rammed it through the parliament in 6 days under a shortened legislative process. And Matovic himself also talked to the far-right neo-Nazis LSNS about supporting and amending the legislation, which was seen as attacking poor children and the Roma minority as well. So clearly, you know, it's really Igor Matovic was, from the very start and towards the very end, the start, the instigator and the fall of this government, isn't it, Sam? And on the 15th of December, despite Eduard Heger probably calming waters for a little while, SAS initiated a no-confidence motion on the 1st of December, probably prompted by President Susana Kapitova's, annual State of the Union Republic address, where she was strongly critical of the Heger government, saying that she would prefer a no-confidence motion. And in early elections, you know, SAS took that by its literal meaning, and the no-confidence vote passed by 78 in favour, and you needed 76 for a successful motion.
Yeah, and I think Susanna Kapitova's own behaviour, I think, is testament to how politically exhausting this period has been, because she herself has announced she won't be running for re-election in the next Slovakian presidential election, despite winning the last one by a huge margin and still maintaining a pretty high level of popularity. So I think that says all you need to know about how exhausting it's been for her having to appoint four prime ministers in the last 3.5 years. But Chen, we've talked a lot about the past and how we got here. Let's talk about the election that we're about to see in a couple of weeks' time. In fact, 2 weeks today, because the parties that are competing, with the exception of Robert Fico's Social Democracy Party, which are leading the fold, the other parties we haven't really talked about yet, have we?
No, we haven't. And to be honest, that it's a story in itself, isn't it, Sam, about some of the stories of the other parties itself. Because the two main contenders for the to become well, I'm going to phrase it in the way of becoming the leader, the biggest party in the National Council, because they're a long way off from forming a majority government. This next election in Slovakia will definitely be a coalition government of some sort. We cannot talk about without mentioning both the Progressive Slovakia, which has at count 0 seats, Sam, in the Slovak Parliament, the National Council, but crucially is a party in which Susanna Kapitova was a member of. And the other party, which has come out of nowhere over the last couple of years, is known as Voice Social Democracy. So dissonates from Direction Social Democracy, which was led by Robert Fico. But Voice Social Democracy is led by the former Prime Minister, Peter Pellegrini. So Peter Pellegrini fell out with Robert Fico. And we're going to be talking about Robert Fico in a minute, Sam. But really, these two parties have come out of nowhere and they are near the front runners, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, and I mean, I think I liked how you phrased your choice of words about the party that's coming in first, because the polls are suggesting that we might be in for a very protracted period of negotiations afterwards, because no party is anywhere close to having the 50 odd seats that Alano achieved in 2020, which put them by far and away the front runners to lead a future government, because I think in the last opinion poll that was published, it would project that the Direction Social Democracy, Robert Fico's party, would have 32 seats. So that's less than they achieved 3 years ago. And if they were to lead the election with 32 seats, there's a heck of a lot of negotiations required. And yeah, it's absolutely interesting, as you said, that Progressive Slovakia, who Susanna Kapitova's party, who despite winning the presidential election before the 2020 election, went into the 2020 election and won no seats. They've got recent history of pretty strong electoral success in the capital, Bratislava, currently led by the Vice President of the European Parliament, Mikhail Semečka, pro-rest liberal party. I think being extra-parliamentary, Chern, I don't know if you agree with this, has actually helped them in the last 3 years because it means they can completely distance themselves from the absolute chaos that has been raging in the National Council. They weren't part of the negotiations at all because they didn't have any members to contribute to the negotiations. And Susanna Kapitova, who is one of the big figureheads of Progressive Slovakia, despite saying that she's not going to run for re-election, has maintained positive approval ratings just by not being directly involved in chaos. Do you agree with that?
Well, I should say Susanna Kapitova was phenomenally popular in 2020 and 2021, but her popularity has dropped off a cliff. I did see reports that her popularity was in about the 40% mark, which by Soviet politician standards is astronomical popular. So I think let's just put it in relative terms that she's gotten a lot more unpopular over the last year or so. I suspect with the entire being associated and having probably caused the ultimate final nail in the coffin in the Hague government. You know, she is part of the whole entire political process and probably was tainted towards the end. So I think that's very critical. But you're right, Sam. Progressive Slovakia has been, by virtue of having 0 seats, has taken itself out of the equation itself. And do you know why it got 0 seats? Because I think it's also interesting to answer that question. And it is because of the fact in the last election, they ran as a joint alliance coalition between the Progressive Slovakia and Spolu, which, if you recall, was during the Czech Republic, was one of the key leaders. But it stands as Together Civic Democracy and later became known as the Blue Coalition. And ironically, now its leader is someone called Eduard Heger, the former Prime Minister of Slovakia. We'll talk about other parallels because I think that's interesting. But in Slovakia, I should note as well that if a part in the last election, the threshold for a party to enter the National Council was 5%, but for a coalition, it's 7%. And that's why the Progressive Slovakia failed to enter parliament last time round. Interesting, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, I was going to say it is an interesting facet of Slovakian politics that you have that different threshold if you're a multi-party. And I think if you have more than four parties, your threshold might even be higher. Is it then 10%? I think it goes 5, 7, 10. Yeah, so that's interesting. And the Progressive Slovakia and Together Civic Democracy didn't get 7%. Do you know what they got, Chern? 6.97%. That is just painful.
But I think counting the lucky stars, isn't it, Sam? Given
Well,
what's happened over the last
exactly,
3 years,
exactly.
don't you think?
Yeah, and one thing I was going to say is that you talked about Susanna Kapitova's relative popularity. Well, the most popular politician in the country and the most trusted politician in the country is actually former Prime Minister Peter Pellegrini, who's leading the other party that is a feature of this election. I imagine will be one of the big kingmakers going into any kind of coalition negotiations, which is the Voice Social Democracy Party, the breakaway group from Robert Fico's party, led by that former prime minister. Throughout most of the last term, they led the polls, but now they're polling in a third place behind both Progressive Slovakia and Robert Fico's Social Democracy Party. But despite Pellegrini saying that he won't rule out collaborating with Robert Fico, he did say that he couldn't imagine his party being in the same cabinet as Robert Fico. So that's an interesting facet going into negotiations, but there's a lot to play for.
Isn't it really fascinating as well? Again, there's parallels between Robert Fico and Igor Matovic. They both led parties. They've both been seen as having somewhat of a orthodox cult-like figure within both Smear and Olano itself. And both their successors as prime minister have left the party and formed new parties contesting in this election as well. Peter Pellegrini polled 170,000 more personal votes than Robert Fico. So he thought he had a mandate to lead the Smear. Clearly, Robert Fico didn't think that. And he has left the party to form Voice. Similar, Edward Heger is now running the Democrats, which was in the last election an offshoot of Progressive
But
Slovakia.
I think the crucial difference is that I don't imagine Eduard Heger's Democrats Party to cross the threshold and be a feature in these negotiations, where Peter Pellegrini absolutely will be if you look at the numbers at the moment.
You're right. The Democrats are polling, shall we say, between 3 and 4%. And even for a single party, we need five. They are nowhere near it. I know we keep talking about we shouldn't be moving towards the future, but I had a funny story on the day of the no confidence vote against Edward Heger's government, which in December 20. Did you hear about what Igor Matovic was up to on that day?
I did not know.
So SAS, who initiated the no confidence motion, said that they would withdraw it in two conditions. They would withdraw it if, because Igor Matovic offered to resign as deputy prime minister and finance minister. In fact, he got to the presidential palace. He offered his resignation to the president's chief of staff, and the president's chief of staff was making copies of it. And Igor Matovic simply took both copies and walked out. So, therefore, didn't offering his resignation and led to the fall of his government, saying he claimed he had a change of mind. Isn't that remarkable, Sam?
It absolutely is, but I think judging by the last few years in Slovakian politics, I'm not entirely convinced that even if he had resigned, we would have averted this snap election.
We probably would not. Sam, let's talk about Robert Fico, because we talked a lot about all the other players, but he seems to be the man who, no matter how many times you put down or write him off, he does come back, though, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons why there's been a lot of global attention on this election is because in this moment, with the Ukraine-Russia war raging on, he could be a very fascinating figure because Slovakia, up till now, has been per capita one of Kiev's biggest backers. And that is in contrast to the fact that only 40% of Slovakians believe that Russia is primarily responsible for the war in the Ukraine, which is the lowest percentage in Central and Eastern Europe. So, as a country, it seems particularly vulnerable to a figure like Robert Fico, who is more Russophilic than any of the other high-profile politicians in Slovakia, and is one of the reasons why I think the global community is quite concerned about this election, because if Robert Fico does win, it might initiate quite a change of pace in terms of a change of direction in terms of Slovakian attitudes towards the war in Ukraine, and especially if he looks to form a government with the Slovakian Nationalists, Republika, Smerodina, who are all right-wing populist Russophilic parties. This could be quite a turning point in the geopolitical arrangement in that part of the world.
Oh, absolutely. I do not doubt that as well. And by contrast, you then have progressive Slovakia, which is a much more pro-EU platform. So it's really a stark choice in geopolitics between one looking east or looking west, isn't it, Sam?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that Robert Fico's made no secret of the fact that he models his political style off Viktor Orban and his more pro-Moscow, more socially conservative, more nationalistic, which also in itself poses a problem for the European Union, even if you take the Ukraine feature out of it, because they're already finding Viktor Orban to be troublesome, they're finding Poland to be troublesome. If you then add Slovakia into that mix as well, you're then having quite a combination of countries proving to be less than ideal partners within the European Union, to put it bluntly.
And I think why Robert Fico has risen to the attention is because of the cost of living crisis, isn't it? I think people can draw a relatively strong link between, you know, his claims of calling ending the war, Russia's war against Ukraine, which will reduce the high cost of living, particularly energy prices as well, and the general frustration of the last couple of years with this pro-EU government. He's been able to tap into that pretty successfully as well. But a bit like Viktor Orban, is that I love that slight contrast with these Eastern European countries, which is, yes, they're Eurosceptic, yes, they're Russophilic, but yet they still support the country's membership of the European Union. And just imagine what would this war were consequence, because Slovakia is a member of NATO as well, isn't it?
Well, exactly. But let's not count our chickens before the eggs, because this is going to be a protracted coalition negotiation process. I said Robert Fico is looking to form a government with the Slovak Nationalist Republican Smerodina. That's not guaranteed. And you have Progressive Slovakia looking to form a government with The Voice, Christian Democrats and the SAS, if any of those can perform well enough. But even that would be a fractious arrangement, because Voice is much more left-wing and SAS are quite libertarian. The Progressive Slovakia wants same-sex marriage. The Christian Democrats don't even want civil partnerships. So there's a lot of things to sort out in Slovakian politics at the moment. And I think this election in 2 weeks' time is going to be the start of it rather than the end of it.
So, Sam, predictions on this election. How do you think this one would go? And let's put it this way. If you state your predictions for Slovakia first, I promise I'll go first on the Netherlands, because they're both complicated pictures.
I predict that Robert Fico's Social Democracy Party will finish first in this election, narrowly, but I don't think him and his allies are going to be in a better position than the Progressive Slovakia allies to form a government, because I think what might happen here is that Progressive Slovakia and The Voice end up performing both reasonably quite well. So those two cooperating are probably going to end up being quite close to the majority, and then they just need a few of their allies to perform reasonably well. Whereas I think the maths is not going to be as straightforward as Robert Fico's preferred coalition. But that's not to say that there aren't quite a lot of difficult ideological things to work out with that Progressive Slovakia coalition. But I just think they will numerically be in a better position to form a government than Robert Fico in 2 weeks' time.
I largely agree with you. I do think that Progressive Slovakia has more options compared towards Smear. I mean, if I were to just, because, and the reason is that some of the far-right parties who could ally with Robert Fico have fallen below the 5% threshold. I talked about LSNS, the neo-Nazi and far-right party. They're on 0.6% as well. So they're like to fall below the threshold. Moss Hit, who was who did form a coalition in the previous Robert Fico government, is on 1.4%, unlikely to cross the threshold too. So I think that those two will ensure that even if Moss Medina, who did participate, or known as We Are Family, did participate in the Hager government, did form a government, you could be seeing that even if you get all the far right parties with voice, you still fall with 60 seats. And I think already, therefore, you will need voice, who I just don't think will put themselves in such a far right, left, even if it's a left conservative government. So therefore, I think we could see some arrangement with Progressive Slovakia, either deciding to team up with the more libertarian Christian Democrats and potentially Saska, now known as Freedom and Solidarity, and that will form a government that will be short, about 53 seats, but with voice on the outside being the kingmaker side on the outside, or the other way around, where you bring voice into a formal coalition, but keep the Christian Democrats and Freedom and Solidarity on the outside and negotiate one-off arrangements with them. That's how I see it. It's a minority government led by Progressive Slovakia, but that in itself is also still very unstable, isn't it? And you gave an economic policy that could give that coalition is much more unstable, whereas the smear-led government, that could be more on a social and ideological and foreign policy one, much more unstable, isn't it, Sam?
Well, there's a lot to watch out for in the next few weeks.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. And so we'll be moving now westwards and talking about another country who is going to the polls on the 22nd of November in another snap election. This time around in an electoral system with no thresholds, which is what's going to make this discussion particularly interesting and complicated itself. We are, of course, talking about the Netherlands, who is about to see a real sea in political change, with the cap of it being that Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte of VVD premiership is finally ending after 13 years. He is the longest serving Dutch Prime Minister and the second longest serving government in the European head of government in the European Union. And Sam, it is not just simply just Mark Rutte resigning as party leader, because the last couple of months, as this snap, as even though the government collapsed early in the year, the sheer number of party leaders that have resigned have honestly beggared belief. All four coalition parties, so Mark Rutte's VVD form a coalition with the Christian Democrats, the D66, and the Christian Union, all three coalition partners have announced that their leaders are they have announced that they are not standing in the election, alongside the leader of the Dutch Labour Party, the leader of the SGP, the leader of DENK, the leader of, and several independents as well. And that has meant that half of the parties in the parliament is going into new leadership. Frankly, astonishing, isn't it, Sam? So, how do we get here?
Well, I mean, thankfully, I don't think the story's as complicated as Slovakia, but it's nonetheless similarly turbulent. And I think in order to properly understand it, we need to go back a bit further than the last election, because if you recall, Mark Rutte's current government, the VVD, D66, the Christian Democrats, and the Christian Union, was reformed after quite a narrow election victory back in 2020. One, which followed the collapse of the government over the childcare benefit scandal. The reason we need to mention that is because one of the key figures in bringing on that scandal was Pieter Omtzigt, who is now a very significant figure in this Dutch election, but also because I think it ended up with Mark Rutte being on a bit of borrowed time because he came out of that scandal having narrowly won that 2021 election. We saw a period of 270 plus days between the election and the inauguration of the Rutte's fourth government, which was just a reformation of the previous coalition. So I think that says everything you need to know about how stable that coalition was. The fact that it took nearly 270 days to agree to the same combination of parties going back into government together. That negotiation period included a narrowly survived confidence vote in Rutte as Prime Minister and a heavily lost censure motion into Rutte as leader of the VVD. There was then a big scandal over Pieter Omtzigt's role in that coalition because negotiation documents photograph that had position elsewhere written to Peter Omsic's name, which led to his departure from the Christian Democrats. He became one of Rutter's biggest critics, formed his own political party called the New Social Contract, which we'll come on to talk about. And eventually, Rutter's government had to resign over irreconcilable differences on immigration policy. You had the VVD and Christian Democrats wanting a much tougher stance on immigration, and the D66 and Christian Union wanting a much lighter touch on asylum policy, which in not only did that bring down the government, it also led to a huge surprise win for the Farmer Citizen movement in the provincial elections back this March, where they beat out VVD quite handsomely for the first place, with the BVB getting 19% to VVD's 11%. And amongst other things, the BBB is a much more Eurosceptic party who has a much tougher stance on asylum and the temporary reprieve for asylum seekers, which was one of the reasons this government collapsed in the first place. So a lot happened. Rutter is leaving the stage as Prime Minister alongside, as you said, quite a lot of other leaders. And really, I think we're entering a period of quite an interesting change in the Dutch party system, because as with Slovakia, the main contenders for the top positions in government this time around are slightly different to last time around again, aren't they?
Absolutely, they're all slightly different as well. And I think the nitrogen protest was really key as well, because the one thing that I think, if you want to talk about party change, the fact that the CDA is really not in the conversation whatsoever. For long-term followers of Dutch politics, or who have followed Dutch politics for many years, that will be a fairly unfathomable idea that the Christian Democratic appeal will no longer be a major player. I mean, until the turn of the 2010s, they were regularly in government. In fact, they only spent three elections out of coalition, which I frankly think is an astonishing record. And they usually held first, second, or third until, like I said, the 2010 elections. That did change. And in 2017, they did perform a little bit better, seemed to be on its way back, but their rural support has completely collapsed over the nitrogen crisis. And that the nitrogen crisis itself, and this is relating to the fact that of whether how much the Dutch should adhere to European regulations on nitrogen that were agreed upon as early as 1991. And that triggered a lot of anger among farmers, which was traditionally the CDA's voter base. And it resulted in the cabinet changing its position several times, you know, and sometimes telling different things to different stakeholders as well. So I think all that led to the fall of the CDA. I think that's really epitomized the fall of the Dutch political party system as well. Would you not agree, Sam, that the fall of the CDA is seen as one of the more appropriate symbols for how that has broken down completely?
Yeah, I think so, because they, even though they've spent a lot of time in quite a number of different types of government, they were always there as sort of one of the reliable coalition partners. And now we're going to an election where really there's a bit of an unknown going on as to what future governments might look like. Because, Chern, I think you agree as well that the sort of three big new political parties to talk about in this election who will be, if not leading the government, be one of the huge kingmakers in deciding who they are, aside from the VVD, who are still going to be a player in this election. But yeah, the CDA won't be, and that will be a big difference for Dutch politics.
It seems really much that the centre-left has been shopping around for a new leader over the last election. D66 was last time round, in the last election in 2021. But now it is very much the Labour Party and Greens Alliance, Sam. And they seem to have nominated a figure very familiar to Dutch politics and European politics in general in the first vice president, Frans Timmermans. So yes, there's definitely been a lot of shopping around, looking for alternatives as well. And even the VVD itself, Sam, with its new leader, you can't write them off in this election, can you?
No, not at all. Even if there is a slight change in how the VVD are approaching this election, because their new leader, Dylan Yeshe-Gozagerius, she is the justice minister and comes from the right of the political party, which seems to mark a rightward turn for the VVD. And I wonder, Chern, if that's a reaction to the farmer citizen movement and Omtzigt criticising, amongst other things, asylum policy coming from a more Eurosceptic tradition. I mean, if I were Mark Rutte, I'd be slightly frustrated about this because one of his reputations, we'll come on to talk about Rutte's legacy in a second, but one of his European reputations was being very frugal and critical of unchecked support of other countries within the European Union, rather than giving grants, instead giving loans, being more means tested. So to have for him to be outflanked on Euroscepticism, I think I would be quite frustrated if I were Mark Rutte about this. But that's certainly something that's going to define this election, because the VVD are going into the campaign with a very different political, ideological energy about them.
Mark Rutte is the chameleon, isn't he? He was much more centrist. And I do agree that, and I think it's a good point to talk about Mark Rutte's legacy, because I do wonder if that last government reform was kind of a coalition of necessity and convenience rather than a coalition of friends. Because if several months ago you did vote against Mark Rutte in a censure motion, and yet now are willing to form a government with him, it was not a strong foundation. But you have to admire his ability to stay on top of the various machinations of Dutch politics for over such a long period of time. And I suspect that stability has ensured that the Dutch probably have a slightly outsized influence probably in European policy formations, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, he has a big domestic legacy as being the longest serving Dutch prime minister. He's led three different combinations of government, with I think his second government almost being the most prolific, because it became the first government since the mid-1990s to survive a full term, despite being what really the closest the Dutch can get to a grand coalition between the VVD and the Labour Party. But the other part of his legacy is that European part, because I think partly because of his longevity, as you said, he almost by default became a key figure in Europe just by being there a long time. It was him and Angela Merkel, I think, that became to dominate the European political scheme. But a lot of commentators have talked about how he sort of became the archetype of how you can grow the influence of a relatively small country within the European Union. And Mark Rutte has certainly come to define that. He became the de facto leader of the more frugal Northern European countries within the European Union, particularly of a COVID recovery fund. One of the big stories about Mark Rutte on the European scene was when he turned up to that 2020 budget meeting on the COVID recovery funds with a huge biography of Frédéric Chopin. And when asked why he turned up with that book, he said it's because that he wasn't going to entertain anything other than his position, didn't know what he was going to contribute to that meeting and wanted to keep busy. So he just sat there reading this enormous biography of Chopin, which I think sort of defines his European political legacy, which is he had an outsized influence relative to the size of his country because of how he operated in Brussels. And he was one of the biggest opponents to Orban in the European Union. He even discussed wanting to reform the European Union without Poland and without Hungary over their anti-LGBT stances. So he had quite a big... He had a lot to say on the European Union stage, and I think the European Union will be a slightly different space without Mark Rutte, because you'll then have a lot more politically inexperienced leaders in the European table now that Mark Rutte is leaving.
Do you think the European Union will miss Mark Rutte, Sam? What do you think?
I think it depends who you ask, to be honest. I can't imagine that Ursula von der Leyen will miss Mark Rutte, because he did become a bit of a block to some progress. But I think there are other European countries who will miss him, because he had the influence to fight their corner. And who are they now going to turn to without him? So I think it depends who you ask. But I think in terms of a political debating space, I think it will be weaker for not having Mark Rutte there.
So that's his international influence, which I do not deny, particularly at the European level, by virtue of his longevity in large part, he did. But what do you think his domestic legacy would be, Sam? Because I think that question's a little bit more complicated, isn't it?
I think, it is a lot more complicated. A lot of people in the Netherlands call him Teflon Mark for his ability to just survive multiple political crises. And he has done that. I mean, there are quite a lot of scandals that plagued him and his government that other political leaders would just not survive. I mean, the 2021 collapse of his government, the fact that he then emerged from that election not just as the largest party, but then remaining as prime minister, I think is one of the most remarkable parts of his 13 years as prime minister, because I think most other leaders who had already been in power over a decade would not survive a scandal and an early resignation of a government of that scale that happened in 2021. And yet he did. Maybe he was living on borrowed time for the last 2 years, but he nonetheless emerged, managed to form a government over a 270-day period, and has governed for the last 18 months with that coalition. And I think that sort of sums up his domestic reputation to ride out scandals. Now, I think a lot of Dutch people would criticize his legacy because of what the scandals were and the fact that he was leading the government at the time when those scandals happened. And some of them are quite profoundly serious. I mean, the childcare benefits scandal is a very serious situation and negatively affected a large number of Dutch people. But I think whatever you say about Mark Rutte's legacy, his domestic legacy survive scandals and still, over that 13-year period, have a situation where his party topped the polls in every single national election and every single provincial election. The only elections they weren't topping the polls of were the Senate elections in that 13-year period up until the provincial elections of this year. And I think that in itself, whether you agree with what the government did or not, is quite an impressive domestic political legacy.
Well, you just have to look at the fact that look at his record in terms of leading the VVD. In the last election in 2021, he remained first, Sam, and crucially got more votes and more seats than he did 4 years ago. And this is despite the fact that was his fifth election he was leading that party, which I think actually is quite impressive, actually, in terms of a electoral record. And the VVD itself, until Mark Rutte, Sam, guess how many prime ministers they supplied?
Zero.
Exactly. Mark Rutte was the first VVD prime minister. So I think that does tell you,
And
isn't
he was
it,
the
that
first, I think I read that he was the first sort of centrist liberal prime minister in nearly 100 years. So then to go on to be the longest serving prime minister after that, representing such a different style of politics than the Netherlands had had at the top of its political system for a century, I think in itself is also notable.
I would probably say that the last Liberal Prime Minister was Pieter Cort van der Linden, who ruled for the Netherlands from 1913 to 1918, i.e., during World War I. So that's how long ago a Liberal has been top the Prime Minister. And the coalitions he formed, if you think about it, his first coalition included the Christian Democrats and far-right Geert Wilders PVV. The next coalition was the Labour Party. And now he's formed the more centrist, I would argue, centre to centre-right government. Three very different governments over there. And it's that chameleon likeness, isn't it, to look towards the right and the far right, to then form a government with the centre left and now a centre centre right government. That's a pretty good political skill. And I think, there was criticism towards the end that he had sort of a very tight, like Angela Merkel, kept things very close to his chest in terms of decision making, which probably did help keep the government for so long. But I also think that did prove his downfall in the end, as people got fed up with that, isn't it?
I mean, Chern, which it leads us nicely onto talking about the main pretenders for the Dutch throne. But do you agree with me that maybe one of the legacies of Mark Rutte is that is just how much he personally has dominated Dutch politics is seen in the race to replace him as Prime Minister without any serious, clear challenger to the Dutch premiership? That almost is part of his legacy and how much he has dominated Dutch politics, and there's been an absence of any serious challenger to him throughout those 13 years and even now.
And I would argue another thing as well as his timing. I think he became, instead of an asset to the VVD, he became a drag on the VVD's vote, because it was quite obvious the VVD has seen an upsurge in support since Mark Rutte announced that he will no longer be running for prime minister. And with a new rightward shift, it is notable that the immediate collapse of the BB of the farmer citizen movement. I mean, at one point they were polling after the provincial elections and the Senate elections, they were touching over 30 seats. They are now polling about 14 seats. I think largely because the anger at Mark Rutte has dissipated with his impending retirement from Dutch politics. That took out a lot of the anger. Some of that vote has gone to Geert Wilders' PVV. Some of that has gone back, ironically, to the VVD. And I think largely that is Mark Rutte himself causing some of that. And yes, let's talk about some of the pretenders, Sam. We briefly mentioned all three of them, the VVD leader, the leader of the Labour Green Alliance, and Peter Omzigt's new social contract, who ironically he will not be a candidate for prime minister, so it'll be interesting to see what they do there. But who do you think is best positioned in this new post Mark Rutte era?
Well, I think it's nice to return to the kind of conversation we were having with Slovakia, in that I don't think anything in this election is straightforward, because the election admittedly is 2 months away, so a lot can change in that period. But if you were to take the last opinion poll as the result of the election, you would be in a situation where the best case, the easiest coalition to be formed, most workable coalition, is one between New Social Contract, the Green Labour Party Alliance, D66, the PVDD, and a raft of smaller parties, which frankly is a bit of a mess. And then you have a situation...
And crucially, no Senate majority as
yes.
well.
Yeah, exactly. But on the flip side, you could have a situation where you have the VVD, the Farmer Citizen Movement, and the New Social Contract. But I can't see a situation where those three parties agree to work with each other at all, because of how the last 2 years have panned out and why Peter Omzigt left the CDA in the first place, and how the Farmer Citizens Movement profited off the unpopularity with the VVD in the first place. So you ask me who is best positioned, and my honest answer to that question at this stage with 2 months to go is I have absolutely no idea. I think it's probably likely at this moment that the New Social Contract will top the polls, but Peter Omzigt doesn't even want to be prime minister. So I don't know. I don't know who's best positioned. I really think it could be anyone's. And I think this election is going to be incredibly close. And there may be some significant mood changes over the next 2 months. Huge peaks and troughs in the polls is what I'm expecting. And I think the debates could make a big difference, because the Netherlands obviously doesn't have an electoral threshold. It's a proportional system where they expect quite wide-ranging coalitions to be formed and the coalition negotiation periods to take quite a long time. But I think crucially what's missing in this election at the moment is a clear preference from the Dutch people over who they want to be prime minister. And maybe some election debates might provide a little bit of clarity on that and might tip the polls in a certain party's direction as a result. I think the Labour Party still needs to prove that it's going to be a big force in the Dutch politics again. I think New Social Contract need to define what their political programme actually is. I think the Farmer Citizens Movement need to prove that the provincial elections wasn't a single issue election. And the VVD need to prove that they can survive post-Mark Rutte. So there's a lot to play for. And yeah, I don't envy you, Chern, for having to go first in the predictions game.
You're absolutely right. I mean, let's just take a look at the last poll. There was last two polls that were conducted. You had the New Social Contract on 28 seats, but pollsters put VVD on 25 to 26 seats and the Labour Party to Greens Alliance on 23 to 27 seats, i.e. a dead heat. And this is not complicated by the fact that in with the Netherlands not having electoral threshold as such, the effective threshold with 150 seats is about 0.67%. So you're going to see a raft of parties with 2, 3, 4 seats enter the chamber as well, which will complicate coalition matters before. I do think that regardless of the outcome, you will probably need at least two of the three big players to come together to form a government of some kind. And ironically, despite the fact that probably Peter Omzigt and the Labour Green Alliance are closer ideologically, there are less options on the left because of that huge centre-left alliance than there are on the right of politics. But just that, I do not think that. So it's they both. So there's more options on the right, but the two big parties cannot work to each other. The two big parties can work together in the center left, but there are fewer options. I think there's a conundrum in Dutch politics at the moment.
But crucially, as I said, the election is not till the 22nd of November. We know that a lot can change in politics in a week, let alone in 2 months. So potentially we'll be looking at a very different landscape in 2 months' time. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right that in this moment, it's very difficult to see what an eventual government could look like unless some big personalities can put aside differences, or there could be some sort of remarkable ideological compromises found between two very different sides of Dutch politics.
And I think as well, Peter Omzigt himself is popular. We know that. The polls show that. He had been leading in hypothetical polls if he had been the lead candidate as well. But Frans Timmermans, do not write off his popularity as well. He was the top vote getter in the 2019 European Parliament election. So, in an era where the Dutch Labour Party, his party, was doing abysmally, Sam, there's no other way of saying it. So I do not think that his I do think his personal popularity in an era of personality-based politics to a large extent, we cannot count that out as well. And the VVD presenting a new face, in fact, she was only really put in there, Dylan Jasigo-Zegaras. She was only really put there and brought to prominence because Mark Rutte made her justice minister in the fourth Rutte cabinet. She was then really much of an unknown, and at 46, she's a much younger figure and has brought a real new energy to the VVD and re-energized it by shifting it from the right, probably taking the sting out of the BBB in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's some big personalities, big parties, and a huge amount to play for. That's why I think, as I said, I imagine the election debates might be quite telling moments. We've talked in previous podcasts about how we're not entirely sure that debates add that much because a lot of it is known quantities. People have already decided what party they want to vote for. But I think in this case, there's a case to be made that they could be quite influential because I think the Dutch people are looking for a prime minister in this election, and the debates might be able to tell them a bit more about, well, the party leaders, half of them are new. So it might tell them something about the leaders that they don't know anything about. It's unusual for an election cycle to have this many unknown quantities at the top of politics to choose from. And I think that makes it really, really interesting.
Well, I promised to go first. So here is what I think will happen. We're probably going to get a government negotiation that lasts more than 200 days. I think that's something which you and I can both agree with. But I think what might happen is that we probably will see, my guess at this stage, with, this, we're recording this on the Saturday 16th, and it's important we say that November is a long time to come. At this stage, I think that the case for change is enough that will probably mean that a new social contract, Green Labour government will be formed. It will be a minority government, and they will rely on ad hoc support from a range of, I would say, centrist parties. So we probably, on some issues with the D66, might be brought into the government because they're all centre-left parties, but they haven't been falling in the polls. I suspect it's punishment for the last couple of years. But with the Christian unions might be part of the conversation. They are, of course, much more aligned on immigration asylum seeker policy, Christian Democrats, SP, Party for Animals. What do you think, Sam?
I think I agree with you. I think that at the moment seems the most likely outcome. The only thing I think might change it is if this, because there are 2 months to go, as we've said quite a number of times now, if the issues being discussed in this election and the attention given to certain issues shifts, that's the only thing that I think might change things. Because if you end up in a situation where the new social contract and VVD because Mark Rutte is not the leader of the VVD, if they start to agree on whatever the prominent issue is on the 22nd of November and head into the election almost seeming like inevitable coalition partners who are much ideologically closer to each other rather than New Social Contract being closer to the Green Labour Party, that's the only thing that I think might change things. Because if you can get the VVD and New Social Contract to work together, it's then much easier for them to form a government. So that's the only thing that I think could change things. At the moment, I can't see a situation where Peter Omtzigt agrees to that arrangement, but that could change.
And emphasis on the word could as well. But if we just take a longer zooming out process, is that we're probably going to see, isn't it, that with these two elections, and it's a theme that we've had, these snap elections, as a closing question, Sam, on this podcast, which has been fascinating, we've learned a lot about two countries and the rather convoluted journey to get to the polls. Some summaries and takeaways on your reflections on what does this say about the state of European politics more generally? Because Ursula von der Leyen this week gave what many describe as a kickoff for the 2024 European Parliament elections next year in her State of the Union address. What would you say, looking at these two elections, the state of politics currently is?
I think both of them represent quite well how different the political landscape in Europe is to 4 years ago. Slovakia's last election was 2020. The Netherlands had an election 2016. I want to reflect more on 2017 than 2021, because I think 2021 was unique in its own sense. But so much has changed in Europe in the last 4 years. We've had the pandemic, we've now got the war in Ukraine, and a lot of the issues have shifted because of those two things, whether you're having more foreign policy focused elections than you did 4 years ago, or whether you're talking much more about your bread and butter fiscal issues because of the pandemic and other energy price related pressures on economies. And both of these countries reflect that significantly, because both of them are going to an election where the party system itself, one of the fundamental things about any representative democracy, is wildly different. I mean, the main contenders, with the exception of the VVD and the Robert Fico's Social Democracy Party in Slovakia respectively, were not main contenders 4 years ago in any way. And I think you can expand that out to other countries. I mean, the UK, I think, is a classic example, is that 4 years ago, you would not expect the Labour Party to be in pole position to lead the next UK government, and yet they are. I think one of the big comparisons about what it says about European politics is how different the landscape is. What do you think?
Yes, I agree. I think the theme of change, and the one word, if I could offer, that describes European politics right now is fragmented. I think these two elections have proven that the main traditional party system, particularly in the Netherlands, has broken down. We've talked about, even in Eastern Europe, yes, the party system is less established because they have a shorter history of democracy, but nonetheless, they often have two or three big parties that are able to garner big percentages of the vote. We are talking here about parties that are struggling to even get 20% of the vote, or let alone 30% of the vote. So I think that is why the biggest change in European politics right now would be. It probably means is that the established consensus that we see in the European politics right now at the parliament level, you see the big groups like the EPP, the Party for European Socialists, might still maintain their role as the dominant role, but they are having to cede a lot more seats to smaller other parties. And at the moment, the grand coalition in Europe is holding. But I think there's further signs right now that with people's frustrations and with over a multitude and myriad of different issues, with all different issues that are hard to solve, that it will be a much harder governing period for whoever wins in Netherlands and Slovakia, and winning the election and forming a government, however long and protracted it will be, is simply going to be step one on what will be a harder road to try and reunite these countries, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't imagine once these elections have taken place that we will be that much more the wiser for what the government will look like for quite some time.
Let's put it this way. I think Viktor Orban will pretty sit easy as the longest serving European leader for quite a while, isn't it? And on that note, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next time when we're previewing a double header of elections taking place in Poland and New Zealand on the same day. And as always, we'll continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @Bella_Talk, and do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.